sort of machine music that, I don't know, it's kind of...
Good evening, everybody. All right, hello. It is the Fakeologist here, Sunday, April 16th, 2023. And we do the show Sunday through Thursday around 8:30. And we talk media fakery, hoaxes, viruses, scams, pandemics, you name it. And we're a variety show more than anything. We talk with many different people. Sometimes I talk to myself. And we have, we talk about crypto as well, digital currencies. We're all over the place. But the main angle is that we are fakeologists. We know that all the major media stories are fake. They are not as they are portrayed. Drills, hoaxes, you name it. This is what the elite do to move the cattle around the different ranches. And that's the main thrust of our show. That's what we talk about. And we have regular guests. Tonight we have a returning guest, Lynn Ertel. She has been requested. One of my silent listeners who called or sent me an email. I think his name was Mike. He said, I love when Lynn Ertel comes on. So I said, yeah, me too. So I better get her back. And she is the chief moderator at the Fakeologist on Facebook page. So I thought I'd have her on and at least welcome her and congratulate her on her new assignment on behalf of Fakeologists on Facebook. So, Lynn, hello.
Yeah, I mean, I think Facebook still has value as an arena.
Yeah, I know.
As a theater of war, so to speak.
I agree. Everyone's there. They're all on it, so we may as... I don't really want to pay too much attention to these forums that delete and ban, but if you're there and that's where you like to be and others are the same way, then I'm not going to stop it. But hopefully it'll feed into the Fakeologist forums, Fakeologist blog, FakoTube, and hopefully that's something we can do.
We get to spread the Fakeologist brand on Facebook, as long as they allow us to keep doing it. Of course, they could, you're right, they could lock us out anytime they want. In particular, I sent a link to you.
By the way, wait a sec. Well, I forgot to stream this to all the affiliates because I was playing around with Facebook. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to restart the show now. The audio people are going to hear all this because it's just kind of funny. But let me restart the show with the new music again. So hold on a sec. Hold your horses. Oh, man. What an amateur, huh?
No. You're a pro.
I'm an amateur.
You're a guerrilla fighter. You're a guerrilla fighter on the move.
Okay, here we go. Good evening, everybody. It is Sunday, April 16th, 2023. This is the Fakeologist Show. I do this show Sunday through Thursday around 8 o'clock. And we talk about media fakery, hoaxes, integrated capstone events. We talk about it all from a fakeologist point of view. There are no other talk shows that have this point of view. And we could read and deconstruct all the media with this point of view and be completely unique. We could literally do the No Agenda show knowing that we didn't go to the moon, that COVID is a hoax, and that viruses are, vaccines are poison. But we do other things. We talk about Epic Cash. We talk about crypto, which is Epic Cash, or Epic Cash is crypto, rather. Anyway, and we have regular guests. And I just rebooted this show because I noticed it wasn't on FakoTube. Because I was playing around with YouTube because they deleted our old channel. So I went back to the older channel. Anyway, without further ado, we have Lynn Ertel, who is a returning guest. And she's also the chief moderator of the Fakeologist Forum on Facebook. So Lynn, welcome back for the second time. We just had a reboot there and now we're on all the platforms. So how you doing?
It's always fun to be here. Always. I liked your earlier allegory about herding cattle because...
Right, that was on the first reboot, yeah.
Yeah, I've come to think of a lot of these sites and limited hangout operations is what you might call a graduated animal farm. Like Alex Jones is a classic example of a graduated animal farm. It's sort of somewhere where people can be sidetracked and held in a corral, you know, and guardrailed against the, you know, the stronger implications of auto hoaxing and fakeology. Just to give you an example of, well, here's something that might be of interest. I just emailed you a link to an article in the UNS Review, that's spelled UNZ.
Ron UNS.
UNS can't be posted on Facebook. It's permanently banned from at least the last couple times I tried to post links to UNS Review. It was Facebook said they were not allowed, and that's been the case for a few years now.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't read a lot of UNS Review, but I like his website. He uses different software, and I think Fred Reed is on there, who I've been reading for years and years and years. And, yeah, I think he's from Maryland, too.
Yeah, it's a very nonconformist kind of publication that he puts out. I think of it as a periodical. Well, this particular link, this particular article, is very, within the last few days, I guess, published, within the last week, is an effort at a very cold, objective view of the vaccine, the COVID vaccines, and whether or not, in fact, they have led to excess deaths and injury. And I sent it to you with the request that you forward it to Frank, the salt man, because I kind of think of him as an expert on this, reading the stats and making logical inferences with respect to the...
I brought the... as you're talking, I brought the article up. And that's one of the reasons why I really wish you could get on Fakeologist forums as well, Lynn, because I know you used to be on. We got to get you back on there so you can post some of this stuff. I know you post most of your stuff to Facebook. But yeah, Fakeologist forums is where it is at. And I do like the UNS Review. If you want to get a hold of Frank, he has a custom email at frank@fakeologist.com.
Oh, okay.
So I made it really easy. I made it really easy, by the way. On Poipus. And we also have Rick at fakeologist.com. Rick does the Rick and Ab show on Sunday mornings, which will come out after I hang up on you, and then I'll put both of these audios up tonight. For all.
Is that the same Australian Rick that used to hang out with Rollo?
Yeah. Rick is similar to you in a lot of ways with his vast knowledge of history and music and culture. I'd like to hear you guys on a call, actually. You'd do well.
Oh, he's an old bird like me. He's just an oldie like me. We're all old and we remember.
He was a fakeologist since the 80s, and he was so afraid of the fear porn, he didn't even buy real estate, and he's kicking himself like crazy right now because he thought the world was going to end. They had him spinning back then.
You know, I'm hearing horror stories about Australia that they're basically shutting down domestic cattle production and pretty much going to be importing everything from China. I'm just hearing all kinds of crazy stories coming out of Australia that make it sound like a total police state. But are those exaggerated, do you think?
Yeah, I think Australia and Canada are the same. They're going to usher us into the New World Order first. I think they really want to rewild Canada and Australia and really just put a few people that are left in the cities, and that's it. I really see that as the end game. You know,
you're driving people out of the countryside.
Oh, for sure about that.
Stack and pack.
Have you heard 30 by 30?
Well, I've heard the 15-minute city. What's the 30 by 30?
30% of all the land will be... Here it is, right here. I actually just typed it into presearch.com. 30 by 30 is a worldwide initiative for governments to designate 30% of Earth's land and oceans as protected areas by 2030. The target was proposed by a 2019 article in Science Advances, a global deal for nature, guiding principles, milestones, and targets, highlighting the need for expanded nature conservation and an effort to mitigate climate change. But really, they just want people off the land. And that's even the indigenous. They want them on. They can't even fit. Like, nobody can go on these lands. Now, in Canada, it's not a real big problem right now because most of Canada is uninhabitable for the most part, but it gets a little more draconian because there's also 50 by 50. And I think you can do the math and figure out what that's about.
So this is the realization of Agenda 2030, right? Or
yes.
And the communitarianism that you've been talking about plays into this as well, I think, because they're going to make the argument that they've got to protect
Gaia
and rewild these natural resources. The World Wildlife Fund is, I'm sure, in on this.
That's, yeah.
His major patron is King Charles III. He's now King Charles III.
Have you heard of Terra Carta?
Say that. Well, you know, you're reminding me of something that Ghislaine Maxwell was in called Terra.
You know about the Magna Carta?
Well, yeah, the Magna Carta is the historic charter of rights that the British...
Take a look at this. Oh, you can't see the computer screen. Terra Carta is the charter of rights for the Earth. And guess you're right. Here's Chucky. Listen to this.
Oh, yeah, they're a big, big pusher that the British royals, yeah. And the funny thing
is take a listen to this. In 1215, Magna Carta laid the foundation for universal human rights. One of four copies is held at Salisbury Chapel. And here he is, the king himself in his gimped-out mask.
The interdependence between human health and planetary health has never been more clear. As we start a new decade, it is time to focus on the future we wish to build and indeed leave for generations to come.
We have a picture of the globe right
Humanity
now.
Humanity has made incredible progress over the past century, yet...
Anyway, I'm not going to play anymore. That's the Terra Carta, a very high-end, expensive webpage. If only Fakeologist had the money to make a webpage like this, but... Yeah, this will blow your mind.
If it really is King Charles in that recording, he has the most Orwellian voice. But I suspect that, I don't know, a lot of his remarks that are attributed to him may be AI generated by this point, because he has a very, very easy delivery to simulate.
Yeah, maybe. I know what you're saying, but even the seal has a crown on it, though. This is Corona. It's just got everything on it. Butterflies flying around, an animated seal.
So this is a return to feudalism. And
oh, yeah.
In some sense, it resembles a historic phenomenon very, very important in English history. Then subsequently, they replicated it in Scotland and Ireland, called the Enclosure Movement.
Oh.
And since you referenced the Magna Carta, at that time... about 1215, there was a fairly wide distribution of land among the peasant classes of medieval England. And there was a development of a market for wool in what is today Belgium and the Netherlands, the Flanders wool market. And the English nobility saw, by about the end of the 13th century, saw very clearly that they could make much more money by fencing in these historically lands that were historically owned by their serfs, fencing all this land in. That's what was called the enclosure movement, to raise sheep. But in order to do this, it meant they had to remove the peasants from the land that they'd inhabited for generations. And, of course, they could no longer farm it. They could only work as laborers, helping to raise and shear the sheep on an industrial scale so that the English nobility could make a fortune selling wool to Flanders, which mm-hmm. where it was made into textiles and marketed throughout Europe. And ultimately this happened. It really picked up steam under Henry VIII when he seized all the church lands and then handed it out to his mafia. And so enclosure proceeded. And then, of course, they replicated the same exact process after the conquest of Ireland. And they did the same thing in the Highlands of Scotland, where they basically fenced in areas, drove people off the land by driving down the price of certain basic commodities or simulating famine, which is what they did in the 1840s in Ireland.
Right.
There was never there was never any real famine. They basically seized the food, the British Army did, and starved the people out.
Absolutely.
So what we're witnessing here is, you know, people think about it in high-tech terms or postmodern dystopian future terms, but it's really a return to feudalism. It's the abandonment of traditional forms of capitalist private ownership and a return to feudalism and serfdom and the manorial life, where serfs were tied to a certain location. In this case, though, they're going to move all the serfs into the cities through an enclosure movement that fences in what was this wide-open country, at least here in the United States. I don't know if it's going to work so well in Canada. I have the impression that Canadians, I don't know, out in the countryside, places like Alberta or Saskatchewan, they live a little bit closer to the land, and I think they're going to be stubborn about being moved into these cities. We've seen the ghost cities in China that were built, and I think these are the models for what they want.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they because the central planning doesn't always work perfectly, they just overbuilt the cities and they didn't have the bodies to fill them at the right rate. And actually, there's some pretty good videos of them knocking down some of these cities because you can't leave a building abandoned for too long. It just goes into disrepair if it's not being used and or serviced. So.
Yeah, I think this highlights their inability to synchronize things with sufficient precision to avoid jumping ahead of themselves, putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah. That's central planning. Central planning, right? Sometimes it doesn't work.
Well, they think they have this notion that somehow or other they could impose it from the top down. But it's really a very clumsy way to do things in the long run, because we all know that peer-to-peer networks that are leveled are much more efficient than hierarchical networks with a centralized authority at the very top. They're peer-to-peer networks, leveled networks, networks in which people participate on an equal level, they're much more adaptable, they're more versatile, they're more flexible, they can change as circumstances and environments change, whereas a commitment to a top-down, centralized, hierarchical plan is always going to run into these problems, and I believe ultimately will fail.
I hope so.
It's going to lead to some chaos, though, and quite a bit of pain and discomfort for a lot of people who aren't prepared for this sort of instability and unpredictability, the total loss of any security. A lot of it has to do with the ambition to get rid of cash, for example, or to move us in a rushed, peremptory fashion towards some kind of central bank digital currency and complete administration from the Bank for International Settlements and the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, these top-down globalist institutions that, at this point, it appears are staffed by a lot of incompetence and mediocrities who couldn't even successfully implement their plan, even assuming that the plan was well thought out. So we're going to see, I think we're just going to see a rocky, kind of wild roller coaster ride as they try to implement these things.
I agree. Why don't we take a look at the Fakeologist Forum on Facebook, of which you are the chief poster and chief administrator right now.
That's very flattering.
Well, you're the main person on it, so I kind of did this mainly for you because I figured, well, if you're going to stay on Facebook, I may as well give you a place. Because we had another group called Unknown Causes, but I didn't really post to it, and it's really not my interest to deal with that.
Yeah.
So I just moved it to Fakeologist, which is a far bigger, more encompassing, obviously, group.
Yeah, Unknown Causes, of course, is referencing the censorship that they imposed on Died Suddenly, right?
You got it.
Shut down, right.
So exactly.
Mimetic warfare. I have to say, I haven't really had to moderate anybody on the fake. I mean, you know, people have made some comments there, but I haven't really had to actually moderate anybody. It seems to be a nice place, nice, very friendly.
Well, does anyone know where it is? By the way, if you go to fake11.com/Facebook, you will get to the Facebook group of which I am referring to. So fake11.com/Facebook. Go there and it'll take you right to the group. And that's how you find it. If you insist on being on Facebook, that's where you'll find it. So take a look at that.
Well, that's good. You have an alternate path to get there.
Well, yeah, because otherwise you're not going to find it on Facebook. They probably won't make it easy to find. Sometimes if you even maybe you can't even type in fakeologist, might not even go through. So, yeah, for sure.
I like the demographics of Facebook. I've accumulated, and I understand that Facebook is infected by bots. There's just bots all over the place, and AI platforms are constantly spamming Facebook. But if you're sharp about it and discerning, you can, over time, assemble around you a network of friends who are very informative, very well-informed, and we kind of reinforce each other and pass information back and forth. And I'm hoping that I think I have already lured a lot of these friends over to Fakeologists, and they love it.
Oh, so, good. I'm glad to hear
you
that.
You know, and that will take them directly to your forums, to FakoTube, and to the various independent venues that you've established. So they don't have to be tied to Facebook exclusively. I see Facebook as sort of a relay station where we can pull people out of graduated animal farms and into real mature, shall we say, graduate and postgraduate level fakeology.
And I just updated the banner there. There you go. Fakeologist.com. We don't believe in unicorns either. What a beautiful banner. I hope
unicorn
this
could be rhinoceros, right?
Well, it's got the LGBTQQPI hair coming off the top on this unicorn. Here we got some, got a UFO, we got a unicorn, we got a couple of these corona virus icons here. We got it all. And remind me to delete this video tonight on YouTube because I'm pretty sure they won't allow this kind of salty talk.
We haven't gotten all that. I mean, we haven't got that close to the edge yet, or we're about to probably, because I'm going to mention this. I think it's a little bit salacious, and you probably think it's a diversion or digression or whatever. But well, there are a couple things going on. One of these is the expose surrounding Milo Yiannopoulos.
I don't know that one.
Oh, well. Between Milo Yiannopoulos and Ali Akbar Alexander, Ali Alexander is a very important figure because he was one of the key organizers of the January 6th insurrection, as it's come to be called, the PSYOP that went down there,
yeah.
which suggests he has a very close relationship, perhaps as a confidential informant to the FBI. He was one of the organizers of that event, and at least up until this moment has been a key organizer of the MAGA folks around Donald Trump. Milo Yiannopoulos, I think people should be familiar with him. He's been around for quite a few years, but he's had a falling out. And as I like to put it, there's one place you never want to stand in between, and that's in a slap fight betwixt two bitchy queens. And that would be Milo Yiannopoulos and Ali Akbar Alexander, because apparently Milo Yiannopoulos has published now pretty convincing documentary evidence from several different sources that this key organizer in the MAGA movement is a groomer and a pederast, and was pressuring, in some cases threatening blackmail over the last few years, against individuals, younger males, in some cases underage males. That's what we mean by pederasty, as distinct from pedophilia. Strictly speaking, pedophilia refers to the sexual molestation and abuse of children. Pederasty is a slightly different situation. To some extent, it has its roots in ancient Greco-Roman culture, where this was a little more common. Maybe not the Romans so much. I think the Romans considered it decadent. But the Greeks, certainly in the cities of ancient Greece, Athens, Sparta especially, Thebes and Corinth, practiced the kind of pederasty where a young male, with the consent of his family, would be attached to an older male, usually a very distinguished member of the community, powerful, wealthy member of the community, to be sort of, I want to say apprentice, but in many cases, this did sort of become a sexual relationship. And you could see it documented in figures like Alexander the Great and his relationship to Hephaestion, who was one of his favorites. And this was just the way the ancient Greeks were. They considered women to be, for the most part, inferior. This wasn't so much the case in Sparta. Women were actually had a much more equal status in Sparta, which was a warfare-oriented society where they had to hold down a population of slaves called helots and constantly be making war on this subject population. In Sparta, I would say women maybe had a more elevated status. But in Athens, certainly, Thebes, Corinth, and most of ancient Greece, women were sequestered in the home, and really not, they didn't have the vote, they didn't have any citizenship rights, and were generally regarded as sort of an inferior species. And this is the roots of the ancient Greek penchant for this sort of homosexual relationship between an older, more mature, sophisticated, distinguished male and a young man. Now, often the young man might be 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. That's what we call pederasty, which is distinct and a little bit different from pedophilia. Pedophilia refers, I think, more strictly to the molestation of very young children. And that's, I realize that's a shocking thing.
Well, what about the Dalai Lama?
Sucking the tongue of that boy.
So I'm going to put a link to pederasty in ancient Greece. Yeah, I've heard the word, but it's nice to have an excuse to go look it up. So yeah, pederasty in ancient Greece was a socially acknowledged romantic relationship between an older male, the erastus, and a younger male, the eromenos, usually in his teens. It was characteristic of the archaic and classical periods. The influence of pederasty on Greek culture of these periods was so prevalent that it has been called the principal cultural model for free relationships between citizens. So they're trying to bring this back, do you think?
Well, there's an interesting gloss on this in one of Plato's dialogues called the Symposium. Of course, we used to study Plato's dialogues in a classical liberal humanities education. You read Plato's dialogues. You may not have. Typically, you read the Republic. You read a couple books of the Republic, which is the Parable of the Cave and the third book of the Republic. You might have read the Timaeus, which is Plato's cosmology, the creation of the universe and his science.
I haven't read any of these, but this is in the Wikipedia as well. Xenophon Symposium, it says here. Xenophon?
Well, the Symposium of Plato is, it may be fictionalized or it may be fairly accurate. It is a dialogue that occurs at what's called a symposium. A symposium was a dinner party, exclusively males, where these Greeks, very educated, cultured Greeks, would sit around and dine and drink the night away, and argue politics, philosophy, science, and in this case, in symposium, the subject of debate was love. And they, and Socrates is leading most of this discussion, as is the case in all of Plato's dialogue. Socrates is the sort of the central protagonist, the central figure. And through the course of it, there is a discussion of Socrates' relationship, a very close relationship to Alcibiades. Alcibiades is a problematic figure in Athenian history. He was a very important politician, general, admiral, and a powerful figure in Athenian life, who was held, he was later sort of court-martialed and held responsible for an Athenian defeat, humiliating defeat of the Athenians during the Peloponnesian Wars. And having been held personally responsible, the council, the democratic council that ruled Athens, condemned him. And he ended up fleeing to Athens, and then he returned some years later. In the symposium, there is a debate on what is the nature of love and how does love originate. And they propagate an allegory that says that in the beginning, how do they explain this? In the beginning, the gods created creatures that were either double male, double female, or hermaphroditic, a mix of male and female, and then the gods split them in half. And, of course, the majority, who were half male, half female, they would constantly be striving to reconnect in order to reproduce the species. But the ones that had been double male or double female, that was the explanation for the tendency among so many humans, in Greek society at least, to prefer homosexual to heterosexual relationships. That was how they explained it, the existence of homosexuality in humans, this idea that originally the gods created this sort of double symmetrical character. This is in the Symposium. And then in the course of it, there is a discussion on the nature of this, dare I say, pederastic love. Alcibiades is sort of joking about it. And he goes into this extended discussion of how he and Socrates were together in a battle during a war. It might have been against the Persians, or it might have either against the Spartans or against the Persians. And they were camped out in the battlefield together. And Alcibiades recounts how he attempted to seduce Socrates. Now, Socrates was older than all these. He was sort of the elder mentor to all of these young Athenians. And he was notoriously ugly, for one thing. He was not very, very ugly guy, Socrates was. And but very learned. And sort of the quality of beauty that he manifested was in his intellect and in the values that he taught the Athenian youth, which ultimately ended him getting arrested, tried, and condemned to commit suicide. And or flee Athens. The assumption was he would just leave Athens and be banished. But Socrates refused to do that. He called together his students and said, I'm going to drink hemlock and I'm going to die here and talk to you about dying for a noble cause or dying for the sake of free expression. Socrates was charged with preaching atheism to the vulnerable and susceptible young men of Athens. That was his main crime. That wasn't really the case. He taught a kind of skepticism. He was not one that believed in the literal truth of the Greek myths. He saw them as allegories, as probably most educated Greeks did. But anyway, in this dialogue, the Symposium, Alcibiades describes how he attempted to seduce Socrates, physically seduce him, but Socrates was a man of such detachment and such pure ethereal intellectual wisdom that he just blew it off. And that got into the nature of love. You know, was it beyond the physical? Was it beyond carnal lust? Was it really something spiritual, something at a higher plane? And that's what the Greeks were always searching for. I'm sorry, I've really gone off on this, but
it is interesting. And this Wikipedia page really is saying a lot of what you said. So, wow, pederasty. They go on about all the virtues of the system anyway. It's interesting. I don't think it's ever coming back in our lifetime.
Well, in its ideal form, it wasn't really what we call pederasty because it wasn't really physical. The relationship between the elder man and the younger man or boy was considered on a higher plane. It was considered a sort of, you know, you've heard the term a platonic relationship.
Right.
You know, you Plato. Go dating, you go out on a date, and someone says, "Well, I'm not looking for a romantic relationship. I'm looking for a platonic, an intellectual, a platonic relationship." And that was really the ideal, not to get physical, not for the older man to exploit the younger male, but to become sort of an example and a role model. Now, this was carried to extremes in the case of Sparta, where lovers were deliberately paired up. Because in the buddy system that existed in the Spartan army, where every Spartan citizen was a soldier, even the women were trained to fight. And, of course, in Thebes, one of the other great cities of Greece, you had the legendary Theban Legion, which was a cohort of warriors. The term for Greek warriors was hep. I'm trying to think now what it was... There's a term for them when you see them with the helmet and the spear and the shield, hoplites, H-O-P-L-I-T-E-S, which in Greek would would be pronounced hoplites, but in English people say hoplites, hoplite warriors. If you see that classic silhouette of the Greek warrior with the helmet and the crest and the sphere and the big round shield.
Yeah, I got it on the screen now.
Greek hoplites. And in Thebes, in the Theban Legion, they were all lovers. They were all lovers. And this was also encouraged very much in Sparta because I guess they felt that it contributed to what we would call in the military unit cohesion.
Oh, yeah. A lot of cohesion.
Yeah, but you would die beside your lover or, rather than suffer defeat, it was dishonorable not to be willing to die alongside. And the Theban Legion, at the end of the Peloponnesian Wars, as recounted by, this would be Themistocles in his work on the Peloponnesian Wars. And we can argue about how authentic this really is. I know there's a school of thought that says most of the Greek classics were really constructed by Petrarch in the 14th century. Yeah, the Fomenko school kind of claims
that.
All right,
yeah. You're talking fakeology. I never heard of that, but that's funny. Yeah, so it's
that's some really intense fakeology because they claim that 3 or 4 centuries were fabricated. A lot of that goes back to Charlemagne. It seems most of these forgeries, historical forgeries, originate about the time of Charlemagne when that calendar was standardized, and the feast days of the Catholic Church were really sort of carved in stone, and one of the documents that came out of that was the so-called Donation of Constantine. That dates from the Carolingian period. And by conventional dating, Charlemagne, we would say, well, he was crowned Augustus in the West, which was unprecedented for several centuries, on Christmas Day, 800 A.D., this was sort of the recreation of the Roman Empire as they saw it at the time. And it became the Holy Roman Empire a few generations later. But, yeah, that's where a lot of this legitimate speculation about the fabrication, faking of Western European history comes from, that is associated with figures, contemporary figures like Fomenko and others. I don't know if we want to go down that route, but that's some deep, deep fakeology. And there's some real experts out there on this you could interview, I think. Check that out. To get too far astray on this, the dialogues of Plato, the books of Aristotle, the surviving ones, his poetics, his ethics, the plays of the great Greek playwrights, the comic playwright Aristophanes, the tragic playwrights Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, and the March Up Country by Xenophon, which is about an army of Greek mercenaries in the service of the great king of Persia, who, after a retreat from a defeat, they have to make their way across like 1,000 miles to return home to the Greek city-states. As I say, the Themistocles account of the Persian, the invasion of Greece by Darius and then by Xerxes, the battles of Marathon and Plataea, and the naval battle of Salamis won by the Athenians, and of course the classic Thermopylae that we've all seen if we watched that digitized version of the story of the 300 Spartans who died basically trying to slow down. It was kind of like the Alamo. Actually, the Alamo is called America's Thermopylae. I've been to Thermopylae when I did a tour of Greece, but it's underwater now. So now we're back into fakeology again, aren't we? I said, well, where did this battle take place? She said, well, it's underwater now, but we're going to take the road around. And Tori, I said, don't worry, we're going to take the road around there, but the actual place where the battle was fought is underwater now. So, I don't know. Did it really happen? Did the 300 Spartans? And the other thing is, if you read the account of that by Themistocles, There weren't just 300 Spartans there. There were another 1,000 Boeotians. This was another city-state in ancient Greece, and they died there alongside of the Spartans. But we remember the 300 Spartans because it's just such a dramatic narrative, right? And anybody who's seen that movie that was very popular, 300, which is, there have been a couple of movies that have been made about Thermopylae because it's just a very, the way it's thought about in Western history is that this was a crucial inflection point, I'm saying, where the Greek city-states united to stop the invasion of Greece by the greatest army on earth, the Persian army, led by Xerxes the great king, and his army of immortals, who are also a group of unbeatable warriors, and the hordes of 30 different nations that lived in the Persian Empire. Really, the Greek city-states were, if you think about it, they were in no position to stand up against this force. But they did, and they managed to, as I say, the Spartans stalled the Persians at Thermopylae to give the Athenians time to assemble their fleet and their army, and to proceed to defeat the Persian fleet at the naval battle of Salamis shortly after, which was decisive because, you know, for there had been two attempts by the Persian Empire to invade and conquer Greece. The first by Darius, who was stopped at Marathon, very famous battle. Of course, the race that we have called the Marathon, that was the runners, the messengers, the couriers from the victory that ran home to Athens and the Greek city-states to report this victory, and I guess one of them died of exhaustion after making the run. And when people run in a marathon, that's what we're commemorating, that run, that great battle. And then a generation later, Xerxes' invasion slowed down by the Spartans at Thermopylae, and then the Athenians, basically, together with the Spartans, defeated the Persian great king on the battlefield of Plataea. And most important, as I say, destroyed the Persian navy at the Battle of Salamis. And that was it. That was the last chance that the great Persian Empire, which was really the superpower of the world at that time, the last chance they had to bring these unruly Greeks under control, because within a few generations, Philip of Macedon and then Alexander the Great proceeded to conquer the Persian Empire. And that was sort of the end of the Achaemenid dynasty in Persia. And that was just a really world historic event, because this is like East against West and Oriental despotism against Western democracy and Western individualism, all these mythic notions that we were all raised on when we studied the trivium and the quadrivium and the classical tradition.
Let's change subjects a bit, and maybe we'll go to some of your other Facebook posts here. Let's go through them real fast just so we keep people interested, and or we have to, I want to try and keep this to about 75 minutes tonight, if you don't mind. But here's one you did on Sandy Hoax. Some truths are debatable, others are self-evident.
Well, yeah, that's an important principle.
What video did you post?
Well, I've usually got Robbie Parker there.
Oh, Max Malone. Okay.
But, well, Max Malone deconstructs Lieutenant Paul Vance, who was the one that actually came out and issued threats. This is relevant because it's going on now.
Okay.
And it raises a question that you've discussed. And I heard you say the other night, the notion that these rotten, corrupt police departments run by their Masonic lodges and their FOPs and their secret societies that are running these drills, these simulations,
right,
and really trying to terrorize the population. And I do mean that, because I turned on C-SPAN this morning, and one caller, Washington Journal, and one caller after another is talking about mass shootings. And people, there are people out there now that think that mass shootings are a regular occurrence, and they're not the least bit disturbed by the idea that the same crisis actor is showing up at one mass shooting event, integrated capstone event,
as they are called,
one right after the other. Like, so for example, one of the videos about this Nashville drill, which is definitely a fake job, was there saying, oh, I just came from Highland Park where we had a shootout.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
A shooting, yeah, but...
I'm on vacation in Tennessee, and I just popped in before even the cops show up, pretty much.
Right, right. And to me, you know, Sandy Hook is sort of the granddaddy of all these. I think not that Columbine, and there weren't so many other events, false flag events, you know, the Nice truck bombing and all these things. You know, of course, we know that for the most part, they're fake events. But Sandy Hook is kind of like the granddaddy of them all for me, because it was so in your face and on such a grand scale. And it's almost like they lifted up the slip a little bit, so you could see how fake it was, with Robbie Parker laughing on camera and Dr. Wayne Carver, the medical examiner, coming out and giving this long press conference where he said, oh, yeah, we didn't let the parents in that night to see the body. We just bodies of their dead children. We just showed them the photographs.
Yeah.
And then delivered the bodies.
How crazy is that?
Which utterly implausible. And then Dr. Wayne Carver laughs on camera. We've got video after video of Gene Rosen auditioning for his part. You know, he's really a mediocre actor. And this particular video that Max Malone did is he assembled all the material of the earlier drills and exercises that Lieutenant Paul Vance, who was running this at a sort of a local level, had conducted in advance of Sandy Hook, including one that took place, I think, the week before.
The concern, and that is misinformation.
Yeah, I remember this.
On social media sites. There has been misinformation coming from people posing as the shooter in this case, posing using other IDs, mimicking this crime and crime scene and criminal activity that took place in his community. There's been some things in somewhat of a threatening manner. It is.
Yeah, I remember all that.
Sandy Hook, to me, it's kind of like a 9/11 in a way. Of course, the COVID is also a 9/11 on a global scale. And we can debate how much the question, of course, I know the conventional conservative take on this, the graduated animal farm, is that it's all about rounding up the AR-15s and about gun control. The variation on that is it's about monitoring students in school using the pretext of psychological issues and all that. But it's much, much bigger than that. And to me, you know, if you were running a course in fakeology, of course, 9/11 would be one of the cases that you'd examine. You'd do a biopsy of that. And Sandy Hook is another. Sandy Hook, the Boston Marathon. These are classic cases of hoaxes.
What's your take on the Fetzer thing being going to some kind of court? I think it's CIA court, but... where he is being sued by Lenny Posner?
Well, the one to discuss this is, of course, Tim Osman of Infinite Playing Radio, who offered to republish. What happened was Fetzer published a book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook.
Right. And he got into trouble for that.
Right. And
so we're told.
Similar. Yeah. Well, Amazon shut it down.
Well, they're going to shut everything down like that, for sure.
Yeah. Tim Osman got together with Fetzer and put together a fictional presentation.
That's right. What was that called?
Oh, it's slipping my mind at the moment.
By the way, IPS.monster, shout out to Tim Osman.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that'll be show note number 8, by the way.
Right. He differentiates between Alex Jones and Jim Fetzer by saying in the case of Alex Jones, they went through certain theatrics and, you know, certain financial deals that are clearly very contrived. And also, Jones never really showed up in court except on video. He was down there in Texas the whole time.
And would that ever happen in reality? I think not.
No, no. Oh. Whereas Fetzer actually showed up in court in Connecticut, where the lawsuit was filed against him by Lenny Posner. And Fetzer actually put up a fight. And so Tim Osman's view of this is that whereas Alex Jones is in on this thing, he's in on the PSYOP and runs a graduated animal farm, Fetzer is authentic. that Fetzer is was serious and principled and has never really wavered in his views on Sandy Hook, that the whole thing was an integrated capstone event, that nobody, well, the name of his book was Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, which I, you know, at the time I felt uneasy about it. I thought it would have been better to title it Did Anyone Die at Sandy Hook? Because, you know, even in the making of a movie, there can be accidents, right? You know, somebody can get run over by a car. Or,
yeah, but nobody died as portrayed, I guess, is better.
Right, right. The essential truth is there that, no, there were no murdered children or students. Fetzer is now saying that two of the individuals involved in this have more or less shown up and sort of apologized for their role in it. One of those being Vicky, the person who played the role of
Vicky. DeSoto?
Yeah.
She apologized?
Well, in a BBC interview, according to Fetzer, there was a BBC interview, and the transcript of it was supposed to be published in a magazine called Majesty, but there's been a holdup on this. It's still not quite clear to me what's going on. At this point, the situation is sort of in limbo.
It's very muddy. It's muddy,
yeah, it's
on purpose.
Muddy, right. And also that one of the children used as a prop in this whose pictures were used to represent Parker, Emily Parker, the alleged murdered daughter of Robbie Parker, the individual who was used in those photographs as sort of a now, like I said, it may have been digital alteration of the faces and so forth, but yeah. You remember the image of President Obama with the two kids on his lap. And one of them basically looked exactly like the allegedly dead victim, Emily Parker.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so apparently the child who was designated to play that role has grown up and is now also talking about how she regrets having participated in this drill. So what I'm really waiting for here are the Sandy Hook kids. You remember they brought the Sandy Hook kids to the Super Bowl to sing? I'm looking for some of these kids to step forward and say, hey, look.
What are the chances? They sign NDHs or NDAs, non-disclosure agreements.
Yeah, non-disclosure agreements, and I'm sure there are threats and extortion. And all
There's no way they're going to give in.
Yeah, the essence of that is that video of Max Malone has that you were just playing from, where we hear Lieutenant Paul Vance threatening anyone who's out. And this was happening in real time. That's an interesting, like the Boston Marathon, which people right away, as it was happening, said, wait a minute, this can't be real. Look at this. Look at that. You know, look at the EMTs. Look at this ridiculous guy who they're in the wheelchair with no blood, you know, allegedly having lost both legs. You know, look at people in almost in real time were pointing out how fake it was. Well, that also happened with Sandy Hook. Almost on the day that the narrative was run down, Alex Jones was up there and others were up there calling it out as a drill, as a hoax, as an integrated cap. I don't think people at that point were familiar with the concept, the formal concept of an integrated capstone event, which you can look up and read about at the DHS website.
Yeah.
They explained how you can participate in one and how the logistics of it are set up and the funding and the moulage kits and the recruitment of crisis actors. But you're right. Everybody does sign, just as in any Hollywood movie or television series. Everyone from the stars right on down to the key grip and the errand runners, they all have to sign non-disclosure agreements.
Yeah.
And that will be their excuse when they're called to account for having committed this treason against their fellow Americans, which is how I regard Sandy Hook. I mean, I was in a Facebook thread, and one of my friends, there's somebody who I've known for a while on Facebook, a little bit emotional. She said she had such a hard time with Sandy Hook because these people that paid the crisis actors were so despicable, so evil. She said this is the very picture of evil, these people, when you watch them grinning on camera. And they're all grinning on camera. My God.
I think the logical explanation is that when you're forcing a cry, the laugh emotion is right beside it in your brain. It's not that they're joking about it. I think that's just, that's naturally what happens when you force a cry.
But, well, some people have called this duping to light.
Yeah, but I really think that's the real explanation, though. If you're an actor and you're trying your damnedest to look legitimate, I challenge anyone to try it. Try forcing a cry, video yourself, and see what happens. See if it looks like you're laughing. I don't think it's a ha-ha, we're pulling a joke on you.
No. The idea is that the really good, talented actors, mm-hmm. they end up in Hollywood and they join the Screen Actors Guild. But the ones who aren't good enough for it, who you're describing, the ones who can't really pull it off, the Gene Rosens and the Robbie Parkers, well, they join the Government Actors Guild, the GAG.
Right, that's Tim Osmond who says that. That's really good.
Yeah, they become crisis actors precisely because they're not good enough for Hollywood. If they could really perform convincingly, really produce those tears on camera, there's never any tears when they're crying on camera. And when you see Robbie Parker trying to get himself in character for that very, very famous press conference, supposedly in the immediate aftermath of this horrible bloody massacre, and there he is hyperventilating and trying to get into character.
Yeah.
And even before that, you see him smiling and laughing, and what psychiatrists would call this is inappropriate emotional affect.
Yeah, you got it on right here on your Facebook post here, so anyone wants to look at that, it's over there. And let's talk about Discord, because Discord was a big thing this week or last week. Do you believe
right.
Do you believe any of that story?
No, it's ridiculous now. That's been actually No Agenda was deconstructing that earlier today. By the way, parenthetically, I heard Adam Curry kind of admit that he thinks the Apollo moonwalks were a hoax.
Why does he pussyfoot around that? 15 years of doing the show. Why is this such a joke to him? Why can't he just say it? It's ridiculous.
I think they're afraid of alienating some of their audience. I don't know. You know, they remember now, they're trying to hold on to a sort of mainstream audience, right? So that's the only way I can explain their refusal to speak out forthrightly about things like this Nashville so-called mass shooting, which is so clearly a fake job, a hoax, a drill. But they won't say that. They won't call it out. I think they know better. But instead, Adam Curry will bring forth the excuse that, you know, it's like MK Ultra. They'll say, well, this really happened, but it's because these unstable people are on all these drugs, these antidepressants and Adderall and all these drugs, the pharmaceuticals that make them crazy, and that's why they do these crazy things. And I think he knows better.
I think he
knows better.
Yeah.
But they did. I have to say, today they deconstructed this phony story about this alleged United States Air Force airman.
So do they call it as a hoax? They never say those words, do they?
You know, they didn't. I don't think they explicitly used the word hoax. They said it was clearly staged. They said they started playing audios and one by one walking through the details of this, is showing how ridiculously implausible it was and how utterly staged it had to be, because the entire world media came out with this story, synchronized all at once. They had the whole narrative out there, and as people began to look at it, it became clear that, because they're saying that all this stuff has been released, but in fact we've only seen a few PowerPoint presentations. Most of the material that someone claims was on that he released into the Discord group that he was running, and no one has seen. So you'd think it'd be everywhere by now.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the manifesto from the Nashville shooter.
Right, right.
Did that come out yet?
Well, this is what I mean when I say they're how do I put it? They put the cart before the horse, or they jump three or four steps ahead, then they have to take two steps back and recuperate and try to reconstruct their narrative. And Sandy Hook, this happened on the very first day, because the original shooter was identified as Ryan Lanza. And we saw the news videos of the police handcuffing Ryan Lanza. And then the next day, it was, oh, no, 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 that was a mistake. We got the wrong guy. It was really his kid brother with Asperger's syndrome, Adam Lanza, who I believe to be a completely fictional digital fabrication. Mm-hmm. I've had this out with people, and actually the Independent Media Solidarity Group put out a fantastic documentary, this was a few years back, called The Life of Adam. And if you want all the evidence that Adam Lanza's fictitious character, a construct, internet web social media construct, The Life of Adam documentary is definitely what you want to watch. They really assemble all that material very, very persuasive fashion. So how do we get into Sandy Hook again?
I'm just reading here that they said the manifesto was published on an LGBTQQIPPP website. Okay, well, where is it?
Right, they get ahead of themselves.
Yeah.
They get ahead of them. It shows flaws in their scheduling, their coordination.
I think it's all chicken feed. I think it's on purpose. I don't think they're...
Oh, you think it's deliberately sloppy? So you're in the school of thought with Quantum of Conscience. Matt McKinley at Quantum of Conscience is convinced that the sloppiness of, say, a WTC-7 being demolished at 5:30 that evening, that no, that wasn't a screw-up. That wasn't an accident. That wasn't a foul-up in their plans. They did that kind of deliberately.
Yeah.
And that whenever that they put... He has a whole video out on this of how they put these so-called mistakes in there deliberately.
They're just talking points. And so we can just talk endlessly about them and miss the whole point. By the way, I'm making copious show notes. I'm making proper show notes tonight because I have a little widget that I can properly put the title of every link that I put in the show notes. I'm up to 11 show notes. So as Lynn is talking, I grab web pages. Lynn can't see them because she's on the phone. But I grab web pages and put them in the show notes. So I'm up to 11 or 12 show notes right now. So getting
you're
back,
you're the ultimate curator.
I'm trying.
You're the curator in chief. Really?
Well, I'm trying. I just try to make it easy because if you're looking at a post or on your phone, it's a lot easier just to click the links. You're not going to look them up. You're going to, if the links are there, you're just going to click on them. So I put a bunch of links to pederasty and integrated capstone events and the story about the manifesto and the fakeologist forums and the Tara Carter and the 30 by 30 and the 50 by 50. I'm doing some show notes for you guys tonight. Hope you appreciate that there. And
yeah, the bottom line on that Boston narrative, where look how they staged the arrest of this guy with guns drawn. Did you see that? Well, no agenda.
Are you talking about the Boston bombings?
No. The release of this alleged leak, intelligence leak of all this information.
Oh, no, I didn't watch that.
Oh, it's ridiculous the way they've trotted the narrative out there. Yeah, they actually showed video of him being arrested with gun, and they drew their guns on him, and he, as though he was some kind of dangerous character, this 21-year-old kid.
Ridiculous.
He was probably a low-level techie, and they're just using his... He may even be a crisis. He's probably cast in the role to play this role of the whistleblower. And it may indicate they're getting ready to shut down the Ukraine war PSYOP.
Well, who's paying attention to that? So getting back to the Discord here. So
the real agenda behind this?
Yeah.
Well, it's to shut down the Discord servers and the Discord chat rooms.
You really think they're going to shut them down, or does it actually make Discord more popular?
Well, that's an interesting idea there, because as a longtime student of market theory, I always see the operation of these things as a balance between rational expectation and perverse incentive. So when Lieutenant Paul Vance comes out on camera, as you from the clip that you played, and threatens anybody who dares challenge the authenticity of the official government media narrative threatens them. He actually, like, we're going to come after you because you're challenging our story. That the rational expectation side of that is, well, people will listen to that and they'll be intimidated and they'll stop questioning the narrative. But no, that's not the way markets work. It also triggers what you call perverse incentive, and that's the tendency of human beings, their natural tendency. You know, if you tell a child, you know, don't touch that, and of course they want to touch it, or don't reach in the cookie jar for a cookie, and you got to slap their hand, you know. The perverse incentive is the urge to be contrary, to be ornery. If you try to censor something, and I hear, what's that? They're censoring it? Well, I want to see why. Oh, they're trying to, it's like a reverse psychology thing. It creates a perverse incentive to do exactly the opposite of what they rationally think would be your response. Not to question it. They're saying if we ostracize, if we marginalize, people will be afraid to question. But no, yes, a lot of people will, because they're conformist and they're intimidated. But there's a whole class of people out there, people like us, that are going to step back and say, oh, really? I wonder why you're censoring this. I want to see. Oh, you're not going to let me post pieces by the UNS review, which I never thought much of one way or another originally. But, oh, Facebook's not going to allow the UNS review to be links to be posted on. Well, I'm going to go out and look. I'm going to subscribe to the UNS review. That's precisely where I'm going to go looking.
Yeah.
And that's called, in market theory, that's called perverse incentive. And with Lieutenant Paul Vance threatening people, well, that's just going to induce more people to say, what's going on here? Why does this guy have to threaten us? And similarly with this whole narrative surrounding the intelligence leak of all these critical documents up there in Boston. This guy was an Air National Guard techie working up there, really didn't have access to anything all that critical, you wouldn't think. It's a completely contrived narrative. But what do you hear the media narrative throwing in? Keep saying over and over again, Discord. Oh, this happened on Discord. Discord is become a danger and a threat to us because it's where people are leaking this vital intelligence. We need to shut down these venues and these platforms. Absolutely. To me, it is so transparently obvious that this whole thing has been staged, whatever the role of this young airman techie, who I think is just being used. You know, is he a patsy or is he a crisis actor? Probably a crisis actor, probably scripted. But no, the agenda behind it is once again to crush, to destroy discourse, and to threaten anybody who's challenging the official narrative of all of these things. And if that means shutting down, and they've killed other platforms before, right? Attacking Discord would not be unprecedented.
My Discord was shut down 3 times, and we just keep coming back. We're resilient, as IPS would say, and we just guide people to our forums. That's where we want them to converse anyway. But yeah, it's...
Perverse incentive,
yeah, for sure.
And they don't seem to factor this in on any. You would think that they would be subtle enough to understand the nature of reverse psychology. If I tell you, no, I'm going to control you, you can't do this, you can't do that, well, you're going to say, well, I want to do it now. You can't smoke weed. Well, I want to try it. You can't. You know, I went through all this in the 60s, perverse. The 60s, this great rebellion in the 60s was all about perverse incentive. You can't do this, you can't do that. Well, we're going to transgress deliberately because we want to show how rebellious we are. And that can be manipulated. The danger there is that can be manipulated. If they're really subtle about it, they can make you do things you really shouldn't do that are really crazy, just by triggering that perverse incentive. Because, you know, people are always operating on both levels. They're operating on the level of rational expectation when it comes to stopping at a red light and expecting everybody else to stop at a red light. But they're operating at the level of perverse incentive when you say, you know, don't consume this or don't indulge this kind of behavior. And they say, well, I'm going to try that just because it's forbidden fruit. You remember the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden from the book of Genesis, you know. What's the motive? What's the motive, Eve says to Adam? Well, the reason why God has ordered us, has said, you can eat all you like from the tree of life. But the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, no, you got to stay away from that. And the serpent tempts Eve and says, well, the reason why God has instructed you thus is because he doesn't want you to know what he knows. It's forbidden fruit. And so he tempts Eve, and I guess she induces Adam to taste the fruit for the same reason. We will know what God knows. We will become like God. We will understand good and evil. We will lose our innocence. And this leads to their expulsion from Eden, as told in the book of Genesis, and also in Milton's vast poem, Paradise Lost. It's just a really strong theme in Western culture, Western literature. Faust, for example, is an example of perverse incentive. You know, he knows it's wrong to make a deal with the devil, to make a deal with Mephistopheles, and yet he is so tempted because he wants all these powers to be able to travel through time and conjure up spirits and demons and understand the deepest, darkest secrets of the universe. And only striking this bargain with Mephistopheles will allow him that opportunity. And, you know, Prometheus giving fire to man, totally forbidden by the gods, punished by being chained to a rock so that a vulture can come in every day and devour his guts, and then his guts grow back. What a horrible idea. That's probably the original prototype for the crucifixion symbolism, I think the crucified Christ is a Promethean figure. I hope I'm not offending Christians by saying that, but that's implied very much in the opening lines of the Gospel of John. In arche en logos, kai ho logos en proston theon, kai theos hein ho logos. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. It was a light shining in the darkness, right? His life was a light unto men. Right, and its word was a light shining in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. This is Prometheus bringing light, bringing fire, the gift of fire to man, which is really about enlightenment. When you could light the fires, you could light up your caves and your houses at night. You could heat; you wouldn't freeze in the winter. But for that gift of fire, that gift of enlightenment, that gift of technology. That comes from eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, there's a price to be paid.
It is. Well, we've been going about an hour and a quarter, and I want to thank you also for getting bumped last Sunday. I had a sort of a conflict with the scheduling, and the other person who was sort of new to the show didn't get back to me in time, so I appreciate you bumping yourself for last Sunday's show, BitCarrot. We were talking about Noster, which is a new platform.
New platform, yeah. People should be checking that out. Oh, no, I mean...
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. The terms of my being your student and auditing your class, as it were, participating in your...
We're all your students. We're all your students. You've been doing this a lot longer. But I'm glad that you're on Facebook, that we can grab your posts and grab your content. And now that you're actively posting on the Fakeologist group, I could probably have you back more frequently just to discuss it in some bit of depth here.
Yeah, the self-evident truth is a critical strategic priority because some things can be argued and debated. You know, if I point outside and say, well, the sky is blue and the clouds are white or gray, you have to agree to that in that moment. You could say, well, yeah, at a particularly beautiful sunset, you get magenta, you get red, you get green, you know, kind of colors. But right now, when we look at the sky is blue and the clouds are either white or gray. That is a self-evident truth. It's not subject to argument or debate, and we should not be wasting our time arguing self-evident truths to people. What is the self-evident truth? Controlled demolition. I know it when I see it. Do you? Controlled demolition should be a self-evident truth. Inappropriate emotional affect, extreme inappropriate emotional affect, like an allegedly grieving parent after a bloody massacre, getting up on camera and giggling and chuckling, that is a self-evident truth that something isn't right here, that somebody's bullshitting us. And yeah, I think that's really important. Right away, cut to the chase, look at something, say, well, is this debatable? Can it be argued? Or is it a self-evident truth? Over time, the things that can be argued and debated about, empirically, we come through the experience of being faked out over and over and over again, and then you become an auto hoaxer. Adopt the principle that a priori, ipso facto, you have to assume that the media is lying and that you can't accept whatever narrative they're propagating prima facie, whether it's a mass shooting or an alleged terrorist attack or, who knows, even an extreme weather event. You know, they could be lying about that. We have to assume they're lying. And I always say, you know, you never know how much of what they're saying is true, but you always know when they're lying. You can always tell because their lips move.
Their lips are moving. Well, we're getting some good reviews. Epic Soul says, good show. Good night, all. Skate and Destroy. I always enjoy Lynn as a guest. And, lots of good reviews here. And we'll put you back on the more frequent rotation. It doesn't matter what you talk about. You can always go on for quite in depth and quite in detail. So I hope
is for you to decide, Professor. You establish the strategic priorities. You set the subject. No, seriously, you're the one that defines the subject matter that's important, because I know you can separate the trivia from the stuff that matters.
I try.
Right away, that's one skill that you have that maybe I occasionally lack, so.
I appreciate that. I'm just looking on the fake, what am I looking at? My YouTube page, and apparently Bob Nodal has a big memorial going on. Did you ever watch Globebusters?
Absolutely, and I hate to, people are really going to say this is tasteless of me.
Yeah.
But I posed the question of whether Bob Nodal died from perhaps an accidental encounter with a laser gyroscope.
Oh my, yeah.
Because if you recall the experiment that he and Jaron Campanella ran with that laser gyroscope, it was a total fiasco. So I posed the question of, maybe he mortally injured himself through mishandling one of these laser gyroscopes. That's probably a tasteless thing to say. I mean,
I do have one question. You know, when somebody dies, if they do die, and they're well established and have money, why do they need a fundraiser for a funeral? I never got that. Like, if you're a family man, you have life insurance for a reason.
I thought this about the Chris Kendall death, because why was his sister raising funds off of it? Why should that have been necessary? Why was that a priority? You're right. I don't get it.
I'm not going to have a fundraiser when I die because I have life insurance. I paid a lot of money for it a long time ago, and that pretty much covers your funeral and all kinds of stuff.
All my paperwork is done on that. That's all been taken care of. Oh, yeah, absolutely. If people who are responsible, especially at my age, have already taken care of all that.
You probably prepaid your funeral already. It's a smart thing to do.
I'm going to be leaving money for all kinds of parties and stuff, you know? I mean, come on. I want people to celebrate when I finally kick the bucket. I don't want anybody stuck with holding the bag. Of course, some people die in debt. There are a lot of deadbeats out there. You know, Thomas Jefferson left his family in bankruptcy and all his slaves, most of them.
Oh, is that right?
Except for the ones they were sold. That's where the expression sold down the river comes from. I'm kind of delving into that. It's disturbing. You know, for such a great intellectual and the author of the Declaration of Independence, this guy really was conflicted, but that's another subject for another. You know, more fakeology in terms of American, United States history and the hagiography we have of these people. These great presidents who are on the various denominations of the cash money that I guess is going to be phased out, maybe. I don't know. We'll no longer be looking at George Washington or Abe Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin on the $100 bill, you know.
You'll be looking at that fat guy from BIS. What's his name? That big fat toady guy who runs the BIS in Switzerland.
Well, I've been thinking of Fifi Lagarde in the IMF, but she's another. Oh, boy, she's a piece of work.
Oh, my God, they all are. Well, thank you, Lynn. I really appreciate you coming on. Everyone loves you, apparently. So I like talking to you. And now you're running the Fakeologist Facebook page. And we like all your posts. You go back on some of the oldies and some of your current. So we'll bring you back for sure.
It's a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And hopefully
take
you get
care,
your...
And best regards to your two daughters.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's brilliant.
Oh, and, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
We'll be back together. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, Lynn. There goes Lynn. Oh, I hate that Skype noise. Oh, I just burned $3. What is that? $3 with the Skype credits. That's okay. I wanted to use some of it up. Oh, that was $4.74. Wow, what a ripoff Skype is, I tell you. What a ripoff. I wanted to leave the phone lines open. That's why I called her on Skype. Otherwise, I use my own line. We didn't take any calls, but we can take calls if you want to call in next time. And don't forget, tomorrow, Mr. E is going to come. He's supposed to be on Wednesday, but he was feeling under the weather. So we're going to bring Mr. E on. We don't really have any agenda for tomorrow. We're just going to talk EGI. And don't forget, we have EGI.fakeologist.com, and we have EGI stuff on Fakeologist forums. But make sure you call in for that if you want. I really enjoy Mr. E. And we'll just talk about whatever's going on during this last month. He usually comes on once a month. And everyone loves Mr. E. Tuesday is Uncle Epic is giving coins away. 500 coins. The Epic Cash community, actually. So check that out. Fake11.com/Epic. Is it Epic 2 or Epic 3? Fake11.com/Epic 2, I think. Let me just type that in real quick. And let's see what that brings up. Yeah, it's Epic 2. Fake11.com/Epic 2. That'll bring up the page and explain how you can make, a whopping 5 or 10 Epic coins. So go for it. It's easy to do, and it'll get you some experience with Epic Cash. And my site is super slow. That's why it's not coming up. You're looking at the pre-search page. That's not my picture. But anyway, fake11.com/epic2. All right, guys. Thanks so much. And thanks for all the donors. Thanks for Tracy or Molly. Whopping 91. She really likes the audio chats as well. So thank you so much for that, Molly. And I don't know if you're a listener unless you either donate at fakeologist.com/donate or send me an email. I do appreciate the emails. Ima@fakeologist.com or on Nostr, fake11.com/Nostr, N-O-S-T-R. Take care, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye-bye.